We bring in Lance Taylor, 94.5 Jocks down in Birmingham, at the Lance Taylor on Twitter. LT, you buy it that in the next few years we're going to go to 8 on the college football playoff because some of this could be money pressure associated with the way television rights are playing out?
Yes, I think it's inevitable. I don't know if it'll be 2, 3, 4 years, but I think the eventual number will be 8. I'm one of those guys, more games, better for me. I just don't know if we go past 8. I think 8 is the number. I think 16 we're getting a little diluted, but I think 8 would be perfect. And I know a lot of people don't believe in automatic qualifiers, but I look at the Power 5 and I think you win your conference, I think you get an automatic bid, and then I think you've got 3 wild cards out there. I think it would be a lot more intriguing. Look, I enjoy the 4. I think it's a better option than what we have with the BCS, but I'd love to see us go to 8.
So if we went to 8, do you like the idea, too, of playing the quarterfinal round on campus and giving a home field advantage to the top 4 seeds?
Yes. I think, to me, these neutral site games that we get early in the season, I think it was kind of a cool concept 5, 6, 7 years ago. I think that's gotten a little watered down now. And I just think the home and homes are so much more fun. And I think when you play these games on campus, if you were to play the quarterfinals like that, I think these teams that are the higher seeds, 1 through 4, have earned that. And I think the fan bases would absolutely love it. And I think that's another thing that you've got to look at, the costs that are incurred. Alabama fans right now, and you see this, I mean, to travel like they have to travel, to go to a city like Dallas and then turn around and maybe go to Pasadena or go to Miami, I mean, the cost starts to add up, especially when you throw in an SEC championship game in Atlanta. But if you've got a home game, most of these fans can drive, and they don't have to worry about hotels, and it's just a one-day situation where you're coming out of pocket.
I also love the idea of the quarterfinal matchups on campus because it's part of what makes college football so great is the home field environments. And you would end up a lot of times with major cross-regional or cross-nation games that you would never otherwise see. For instance, you could have SC coming to Alabama. I don't know the last time SC played a game and traveled from L.A. to come to play a game in Alabama. It might have been the Sam Bam Cunningham game back in like 1968 or whatever the heck it was. There are a lot of really cool games that you could get that would cross-pollinate the different regions of the country. And look, I mean, if you're a Big Ten school, and let's say that Ohio State's getting to host a home playoff game, and they bring up a school like Florida, well, we'll see. Does December football matter? Playing in cold weather, you get the advantage of all these different home field aspects that we see in the NFL, right? Every year in the NFL, people say, man, it's hard to go into Foxborough and win come January. It's going to be really cold. We know how good Tom Brady and Bill Belichick are. It seems like the Patriots always root for it to be frigid when they're playing a dome team or they're playing a team from warm weather environments. I just think it adds a whole nother wrinkle to the game in general. Now, there, I was like really surprised. I think it's smart, but I was surprised that it's already gotten to this level when I saw one of the Fox presidents, Mark Silverman, at the Big Ten Network basically throwing haymakers at Comcast over this carriage battle. Now, you're a big college football fan, LT. I don't know who your provider is when it comes to television. I think it's DirecTV because I think you got like 8 of those in your house, so you don't miss any sports. 8 receivers or something. But
sadly, this is a sad commentary. I've got 15 receivers in my house.
15 DirecTV receivers.
And DirecTV jams me up for $10 a receiver every month, which is completely pathetic. You don't even want to see my bill. Yeah.
Okay, so you have got like a different caliber. How much time do you spend watching the Big Ten Network?
Not a lot. Here's what, I'll have the Big Ten on one of my TVs. Like, I've got a pretty, I don't want to say elaborate, but a pretty good setup in my like downstairs guy room, whatever you want to call it. But I'll have those early 11 o'clock Big Ten games on, a couple of them. Never sound. They're just kind of the throwaway games. But I don't really spend any time watching the Big Ten Network. As a direct TV consumer, the thing that bothers me the most, that I'm a USC fan, and if USC is ever on the Pac-12 Network, which is once or twice a year, typically they get more mainstream games than a lot of the other schools. But when they're on the Pac-12 Network, you can't find them. I mean, DirecTV just doesn't have access to the Pac-12, and nor does that look like it's going to happen in the near future.
Yeah, which is what I was going to ask you, and that's a good point on the Pac-12 not being on DirecTV, the Pac-12 network. How many people out there do you think make a decision not to go with a particular provider? Because this is where we're headed towards this big battle between the Big Ten Network, which is majority or half-owned by Fox and the Big Ten, and Comcast, is that for a long time the rule has been people will revolt if your games are not on, you know, the overall carriage. And then the DirecTV did something interesting. They basically told the Pac-12, hey, we don't think there's enough demand for the Pac-12 network to be even included in any kind of facet on DirecTV. And I don't think DirecTV has really seen a hit from it. You just said you're a big college football fan. You didn't switch off DirecTV to make sure that you got the Pac-12 network. I don't know if Comcast is willing to go all the way on this, but the big question has been the threat that all these conferences and all these teams and all these different partners will levy is, oh, people will leave their cable or their satellite provider if you don't carry this channel. And then I always wonder how many people would actually do that, because DirecTV called the Pac-12's bluff, and it doesn't seem to have impacted their business very much at all.
Well, here's the reason, Clay. Because DirecTV has always swung the biggest stick because they've got the contract with the NFL.
Yep.
I would have left DirecTV years ago if they didn't have that NFL contract.
Sunday Ticket.
But, Sunday Ticket. But if I've got to get Sunday Ticket because I can't watch my Rams. Now, the Rams are going to be more mainstream. They've got 5 primetime games this year, but I'm not going to miss a Rams game. I mean, that's my weekends really revolve around 3 o'clock kicks with the LA Rams. And so it's, you know, do I leave DirecTV? It's really impossible being a huge NFL fan. Now, there are people out there that will just have one receiver and pay the minimum DirecTV fee and just have that one setup on one TV. But I like to watch multiple NFL games on a Sunday. So, you know, I'm kind of hostage to DirecTV. If the NFL Sunday Ticket ever goes to other providers, I would definitely leave DirecTV just where I would have access to the Pac-12 network.
How much? Yeah. So, and that's the big question here is how many people, and I don't think the Big Ten knows it. I mean, I think they can do all their surveys. I don't think Comcast knows it because I think this is going to turn into a big battle. That's the question is how many people would actually change their behavior? And the trend line for years has been, oh, eventually everybody's going to buckle and end up paying for sports. But to me, sort of the first major provider to eventually hold the wall was DirecTV on the Pac-12 network. And now the Big Ten network is certainly, Big Ten fans are more fervent and passionate certainly than Pac-12 fans. I don't think even Pac-12 fans would dispute that. And the ACC network is supposed to launch next year, which is going to be even its own kind of mess. But I just genuinely wonder what's going to end up happening here. And how many Big Ten fans would just say, you know what, I'll leave, especially if other providers start to also hold the wall. Because there's lots of people out there, let's be honest, who pay a lot of money for all of these sports rights and never watch the games. Like you and I, we sit around and watch games all day. So it's a pretty good deal for us when it comes to sports. What do you think, like the ACC network? Do you see a great demand out there for the ACC network?
I don't. I mean, even the SEC network, you know, I watch it, but it's not premium games. You know, and right now, I mean, you know, we have it on in the studio every day when we're doing our show, and it's kind of laughable. We brought this up to Greg Sankey before, and I don't think he wants to hear it because we're trying to program his network. But there are better options on these networks than playing, you know, Missouri, South Carolina volleyball. You know, really, we pay for these networks for 2 or 3 games each Saturday. You know, for 11, 12 Saturdays a year. I mean, outside of that, I'm not watching the SEC network. I'm not watching the Big Ten. I've never been able to find the Longhorn network. I don't know if it exists.
Yes.
Again, the Pac-12 it's the yellow cardinal. I mean, it's just something you don't see. And can you imagine if the SEC network was buried like that? And I mean, how many, and you know how passionate the fan bases are in the SEC, but they would switch from DirecTV in a day if they knew that they were going to miss 2 or 3 games a year.
Yeah, I think that's the question on passion. And that's why on some level, the conference network era to me has occurred at this interesting time where what I think is going to end up happening is everybody is going to start to pay for everything that they want in this different kind of bundle, right? And what I mean by that is,
and I would take that, man. I'm an a la carte kind of guy. You know,
yes.
When I go to a restaurant, I like to hand select different things I want on the menu. And as a television consumer, I'd like to be the same. You know, I mean, it's great. You remember back in the days when we had like 30 options with the remote, and now we've got like 300 plus options, but I still can never find anything I want. Typically, when I go to the TV, DirecTV, I'll start in the 500s and just look for a random movie. But normally, when I turn on the television, I'm kind of a guy. I know exactly where I'm going to go and exactly what I want. So, you know, with that said, I'm an a la carte kind of guy, and, you know, I could choose 5 to 10 options and be completely happy with it.
What I mean by that, too, is this is interesting. Like, there's this idea that you're going to save a lot more money without having to pay for a cable or satellite subscription. I know there's a lot of people listening to me right now who have, quote-unquote, cut the cord, right? They've moved on to a different way to consume sports, whether it's illegally streaming it, because you can find almost all these games now through a variety of different sources online. And you don't even need to have a cable and satellite subscription. Now, I think that's probably the younger crew that understands how to find those games that are streaming on Reddit feeds and everything else. My kids know how to do it. You know, they're 10 and 7. They understand how to use the Xbox to go on and find any game, even though we've got cable and satellite. But what is interesting to me is, let me just leave aside my cable bill. Let me leave aside your satellite bill. I pay for Amazon Prime, which gives us, you know, the Amazon access. That's like $12 a month or something like that, if I'm not mistaken, or $120 a year or whatever it is. Basically, $10 to $12 a month. I pay for the WWE Network because my kids are absolutely obsessed with the WWE. I pay for Netflix. We have like a Spotify subscription. Like, I start to add up all of these different monthly subscription costs that our family has, and obviously I've got a full house with three kids, and now Disney is going to do their own streaming service. I think we might even have Hulu. Like, we got satellite radio. I start to add up all of these different little entertainment options that we have in this house, and even before I get to cable, we almost have another cable bill that is a bundle of all of those different assets, right? And so I understand this like thing at the end of the rainbow is, oh, the consumer is going to save money. I'm just not sure that I buy it because I think big business is going to find a way to make us pay for everything.
I don't know what the option is. And,
yeah.
And now you start throwing this out there, and I start thinking about some other things, you know, my Vudu that I've got, and just some of these other services that I don't even think about, but I'm getting tagged every single month. It's really disturbing when you think about it, and half the stuff I don't even use.
Yeah, right. I mean, and once they get your credit card on that recurring bill, it's almost like if you're paying $9.99 a month, you're like, man, I don't even want
to get it canceled. You just keep it going.
Exactly, because you don't want to get on the phone and have to call somebody and spend 30 minutes to get something canceled when you're only paying $10. You're like, I'm too busy to do that. I am really fascinated by this. I'm going to open up the phone lines. Good stuff. LT, last question for you. The question that won't die. Nick Saban continues to talk about it. I think he talked about it in the media yesterday. Come opening game against Louisville, who's Alabama's quarterback?
Well, I think your starting quarterback that game is going to be Jalen Hurts. I think ultimately the quarterback is going to be Tagovailoa. I think he'll be your starting quarterback for the majority of the year. I thought it was really telling, though, with Nick Saban making his rounds through Bristol, when he came out yesterday and he said that Jalen Hurts actually came to him and said, I'm going to be here. I came here to get an education. I graduate in December. I'm going to be here. With that said, a lot of people thought Jalen Hurts would transfer before the season. Now if he sticks it out, plays through December, he can become a grad transfer. What's going to be interesting, Clay, with the new rule, the new redshirt rule, if he plays more than four games, he's only going to have 1 year left. If he plays in four or less, he could transfer somewhere and have 2 full years remaining of eligibility. But I think Jalen Hurts will start week one against Louisville, and then I think it'll be Tagovailoa's job moving forward.
It's Animal Thunderdome time. Cue the music, boys.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I'm just glad I was there.
Boys and girls.
I thought he thought I was like this ginormous piece of chicken.
Dying time's here.
I had a boa constrictor stuck to my face.
Sam, you have a what?
This is Animal Thunderdome.
What you got for me, Danny G?
All right, you are going to love this story. A massive mountain lion made itself right at home in an Oregon woman's living room. It took a six-hour nap behind her sofa until she says she telepathically got it to leave. Lauren Taylor of Ashland, Oregon, was shocked to find this large cat in her home in July. She thinks that the cat probably wandered in through an open back door after drinking from a pond in her yard. She chronicled the whole experience on her Facebook account, which has received thousands and thousands of reactions. She says the door was open and the room has huge plants and stairs built around a real tree, so the cat didn't likely realize it was walking indoors until it was inside. The mountain lion initially tried to leave the room but got scared when Taylor's roommate screamed, so it ran behind the couch where it then fell asleep. Taylor believes her this is where it gets good. Taylor believes her extensive experience working with energy and animals made the meeting a peaceful and pleasant one. She says that she does not recommend seeking out encounters with wild animals, but she says, when I made noise, the cat woke up and looked startled. So I consciously raised my frequency, gazed lovingly into the cat's eyes, and communicated using feline speak, eye blinking to calm her, she wrote. Cuckoo. When it came time for Taylor's new pal to leave, she says she played a drum, she says, and the kid telepathic pictures of routes out of the house via open doors and the route out the backyard across the creek through an open field and into the hills. The cat did leave, so Taylor believes she telepathically got this mountain lion to leave her home.
Not the kind of guy typically to root for the mountain lion to attack someone. I might be on the mountain lions. This might be the first time we've had an Animal Thunderdome's story where I've thought, you know what? The animal, I wouldn't blame it at all if it decided to attack this person. What else you got for
all
me?
All right, really quick, from Alamogordo, New Mexico. Officials say a 70-year-old southern New Mexico man who regularly feeds wildlife at his home suffered multiple injuries when he was bitten by a bear as he stepped outside. The State Game and Fish Department says that the man at his Cloudcroft home last Friday, his wife had to drive him to the hospital for treatments of injuries that included huge arm puncture wounds and leg scratches. According to the Game and Fish Department, the man acknowledged that he feeds cracked corn to wildlife and bears routinely at his residence. Officers found pet food bowls near the house, bear prints on his windows, and scratch marks all over the porch. Department Director Alexandra Sandoval, she says, it's not a good idea ever to feed wildlife.
Yeah, bears in particular.
Yeah.
So this guy. If you feed bears, it ends badly.
This guy finally paid the price for his hobby.
What an awful hobby that is anyway. Sometimes the animals are justified in the people they attack. Both of these stories today, I would have been totally on the side of the animals if they attacked the humans. It's rare I root for the animals in the great Animal Thunderdome battle against the humans, but I think both of the animals would have been justified in their battles if they had gone after either of these people. We're talking to Ryan Glasspiegel now. He writes at The Big Lead, does good work. He can tell us what his Twitter handle is as we get rolling here. But I want to ask first question for you, Ryan. You are a Wisconsin alum. You're a big college football fan, a Big Ten fan, and you have Comcast. What is your thought on this battle between Comcast and the Big Ten since it went public yesterday at the Big Ten Media Days?
My thought is that they better figure this out somehow because I'm in an area where there isn't a ton of alternatives. I tried to crawl away from Comcast a few months ago, and I went to AT&T. UVerse, and the way that UVerse works is the TVs run on Wi-Fi, and I haven't had a weather-related television outage on Comcast in like 8 years or something, but on UVerse, the TVs run on Wi-Fi, and Wi-Fi glitches all the time, and so the TVs would freeze, and I just couldn't stand it, and I had to go back to Comcast, so I'm really not looking forward to the possibility that they make me leave the house to go watch Badger games.
Yeah, and I think that's a question that a lot of people have had because I feel like there's a lot of our listeners who have experimented, and I was talking about that in the last segment with, for instance, I have a Apple TV, and so I downloaded the ESPN app to be able to watch multiple games on my screen at once. And I found two things happen regularly. One, I would get what you just said, a glitch where my Wi-Fi signal, and everybody knows this experience, like your Wi-Fi signal for whatever reason isn't consistent. And so you'd freeze. And you might freeze like at the absolute moment when somebody's about to kick a game-winning field goal or whatever else. I also found that my internet streaming of the games was slower. Now, you write and talk and interact a lot with people on social media. Did you find that to be an issue as well?
Well, yeah. There were times where I would get texts 30 seconds before, for example, a Brewers at bat happened. Because it's not even just Twitter. I think a lot of the way that people watch games now is with these text threads. So if you're a minute behind the eight other people on your thread, that's just an untenable situation for somebody like me. And but with these skinny bundles, those are a big risk. YouTube TV went down during the World Cup and Wimbledon like a couple weeks ago because the volume of users was so high, I assume. So I think if you're just a dyed-in-the-wool sports fan, especially if you do it for a living, but I think if you're a diehard fan, it's really tough to – it's a big risk to cut the cord and go to one of these streaming bundles.
We're talking to Ryan Glasspiegel, his Twitter handle, @SportsRapport. I'll tweet it out for you when we put up the podcast for sure. I've got a poll question up, Ryan, and over 5,000 people have voted so far. It says, and the question's pretty simple, would you drop Comcast or any other cable or satellite provider if they stop carrying the Big Ten Network? Now, full disclosure, obviously, I have a lot of SEC fans who follow me, so there could be some animus directed at the Big Ten because of the rivalry between the SEC and the Big Ten. But I'm kind of surprised by this in general. 75% of my followers, at least those voting in the first 30 minutes of this poll, are saying no, they would not drop Comcast. How do you think Big Ten fans in general are going to respond if this battle continues? And for people out there who are just waking up and they don't know, the reason why we're discussing this, the Fox Sports president, Mark Silverman, was at Big Ten Media Days yesterday, basically letting everybody in the Big Ten Conference know that their deal, I believe, expires on August 31st. So, in theory, the Big Ten Network might not be carried on Comcast when the season begins. Now, a lot of times these situations end up resolving themselves. You're in Chicago. You know a lot of Big Ten fans. Do you think there is or are a lot of people who would be willing to switch? You yourself just said, I guess I'd have to go to a sports bar. How many times was Wisconsin on the Big Ten Network last year? Do you know?
It feels like, well, so first of all, the Big Ten games on FS1 are also going to be affected. So that it adds another chunk.
Yeah, and that's also a little bit wild. I don't even know how that would work exactly, because I guess they would black those out in Comcast households. Is that how that would work? I don't even understand how that would work.
Yeah, and it's also really weird because I can't just go and look at Wisconsin's football schedule right now and see how many of their games are on Big Ten Network or FS1 versus ESPN, ESPN2, or ABC, because they only tell you where the game is going to be televised like 2 or 3 weeks in advance.
Yeah, so and frankly, they may not even know because of the way the draft happens, and a lot of times, networks make decisions based on how good the season is going. I had a lot of Ohio State and Michigan fans hop in and say, yeah, most of our games I know are not going to be on the Big Ten Network, so I would go for the one or maybe two of those games that would not be on Fox or ESPN and go watch them, or ABC, and go watch them in a sports bar. But, if you're Rutgers, I would guess that a lot more of your Rutgers games are going to be on, for instance, the Big Ten Network.
Yeah, maybe it's 4 or 5 of Wisconsin. It's not a really big deal if they're playing at 2:30 Central or a night game, but those games where they're playing at 11 a.m. and maybe you went out the night before on a Friday, you're really not trying to leave the house to watch the games. And if that happens, I assume that'll happen to me once or twice where they're playing at 11 a.m. on Big Ten Network. Now, you said most of these get involved, but as my friend Patrick Crakes, who used to be a program executive for Fox Sports, said, that Comcast and YES Network had a dispute in New Jersey that lasted an entire season, and Yankees fans just couldn't see their games. And you've covered this a lot over the last couple months on your show and your website, that Comcast and Fox have an acrimonious relationship. Comcast tried to acquire the bundle of the Fox assets that are ultimately going to Disney. Rupert Murdoch, for whatever reason, had a strong preference for those assets to go to Disney instead of Comcast. And this is just another stage in that battle.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt at all. And by the way, all of the SEC Network's deals, I'm told, are pretty much up next year, and that's going to get incredibly contentious because the ACC Network is trying to launch into maybe the worst environment for a brand new conference network we've ever seen. Do you think there's much demand for the ACC Network, and do you think ESPN's going to run into a lot of challenges next year trying to get this thing rolled out?
There's going to be regional demand for it in like the Carolinas for Duke and UNC, NC State, or in Florida for Florida State. But I don't see anybody in Chicago, for example, banging pots and pans demanding ACC Network carriage.
Yeah, I think that's 100% true. All right, I want to get into a couple of other interesting issues with you. You tweet, I guess on Monday, maybe on this show, I came on and said, hey, I've got a solution for the Anthem controversy. Why can't we just end up with a compromise? And you had had the same compromise before. It is end marijuana testing in exchange for all of the players to agree to stand for the national anthem. This was, I think, pretty favorably received. People are over the anthem controversy. What was the response when you found that you shared that idea with your audience?
I did a poll and asked which side would say no, and two-thirds of it said the owners. Now, this would be a tough pill for everybody to swallow because the players would be accused of selling out their beliefs for a freedom to get high, and the owners would be accused of selling out their beliefs in exchange for giving the players the freedom to get high. But like, just look at Josh Gordon and how many millions of dollars that he's lost just because, frankly, of the marijuana testing policy. And he left the Browns recently to go get treatment. Would he need to go get mental health treatment if he were allowed to smoke marijuana? I don't know that we can definitively answer that either way, but we do know that he would have made millions and millions of more dollars throughout his career if this kind of nonsensical prohibition weren't there. So there's some people are so entrenched on their sides of the anthem controversy. The NBA was really smart to avoid this 25 years ago. They got lucky in a sense that the issue popped up during a period where the Democrats and Republicans didn't have as contentious a relationship as they do in this present time. But the NFL has to figure this out before this season, or I think they're going to have some really big viewership consequences.
I agree with you on all of that. Now, another big story, and we haven't talked a lot about this because it just happened a couple of days ago, but the New York Daily News just cut, I believe the number is 25 of its 34 sports media employees. If you're not familiar with the New York Daily News, it's a massive daily tabloid. Used to have one of the biggest readerships in the entire country. Would go head-to-head with the New York Post in terms of trying to reach the masses in the New York City area. What to you is the significance of this decision with about half of the employees being let go at the New York Daily News, including whatever it is, like 75% effectively of their sports department?
It's really sad. They've had financial issues for at least 25 years, so I don't think that you can say that it's a total surprise. They were owned by one of these billionaire owners that everybody seems to want, but he couldn't find a buyer, so he sold it to Tronc for a dollar. And when you see a company like Tronc that's just known for making wide sweeping cuts everywhere they go, buy, acquire a paper at that price, you know that there's a lot of pain coming, but I still don't know that you can know that the amount of pain that's coming is that your sports section, which has been revered, Mike Lupica, probably one of the most famous sports writers ever, has anchored that page for Lord knows how long. And Frank Isola has been there for 25 years. He used it as a platform to get to Around the Horn and elsewhere. There's nothing that can prepare you for the sports section getting cut by 75% and not having a Yankees writer when they're in the middle of a pennant race. That's just insane.
Yeah, it is wild in general. What does this say about the overall trajectory of sports and media coverage in general? My contention is that, and you probably see this a little bit at the Big Lead, and we're talking to Ryan Glasspiegel. His Twitter handle is at SportsReport. You probably see to a certain extent that the challenge in general is written form. I still write at OutKick, but what people respond to the most by far is my radio, my daily Periscope, and Facebook, which people can watch around 3 o'clock Eastern. Like, that's what people respond to. The amount of people who are paying a lot of attention to written content, I think every year continues to decline. And so, as a result, is the challenge of monetizing it, because so much, frankly, of the advertising market on the internet is fundamentally broken because you're paying based on quantity of page views as opposed to quality of page views. How optimistic, how pessimistic are you? Are things getting better or worse for the written word online?
Well, there was a tweet floating around yesterday that said something like 538,000 journalists have lost their jobs since 2001, and only 24,000 coal miners have. And the implication was, why we kowtow to the coal miners but not the journalists. But digital journalism jobs, I think, have made up about two-thirds of those losses, because that was specifically newspaper journalists who have lost their jobs. So it's bad, but it's not quite as dire as a tweet like that would make it sound. I don't know that I'm getting more optimistic for the written word. You've written about this a lot, how it's inefficient that the unique page view is the prevailing metric for how web journalists are judged for the merits of their work, because for some reason, under the unique page view, somebody who comes by from Facebook for 5 seconds, he's a reader of Facebook, he's not a reader of your site, and he never returns. He counts the same in the unique page view as somebody who goes to OutKick the coverage's homepage, maybe not 20 times a day because you're not publishing a volume like we do at the Big Lead, but somebody who reads every post you do all month counts the same in the unique page view stats as somebody who comes from search or whatever. And we keep hearing that that's going to change and that they're going to start measuring total time of engagement, which I think is a much more reasonable statistic for everybody to be judged on. But I keep hearing that, and then I keep seeing that unique page view is the statistic that's cited to see everybody's merit. So I don't totally believe that that stat is going away, even though it should be. You know, I don't think that you can just go into this profession now as you maybe could 10 or 15 years ago with the goal of being just a writer. Although I think I would dispute with you that maybe you personally get more engagement from radio because you're on this massive distribution of Fox Sports Radio and iHeart Premier. But I find that if you write something that is very original and nobody else has had this opinion or this fact, that it still gives you an enormous amount of power, even if it's difficult for that written word to be monetized.
Jason Whitlock with us now at Whitlock Jason on Twitter, waking up early with us in L.A. as he gets ready for Speak for Yourself, his show. Check it out on the afternoons at SFY on Twitter there and on FS1 every day. Jason Whitlock, we've been talking a lot about today's show, about whether you have ever been willing to change your cable or satellite company because you weren't getting games that you wanted to get. I don't know what your cable or satellite situation is in LA, but have you ever been there as a fan? I know you moved away from Indianapolis to Kansas City, then Kansas City to LA. Have you ever wanted to be watching games, not been able to get them, and had that struggle that I think a lot of fans have had as Comcast and the Big Ten get up in arms over their fight, where you've had to be like not able to see a game and you're frustrated because of that?
Well, it happened with the NFL package where I had to switch to DirecTV so I could get the NFL package. And then I moved to a place where you couldn't get DirecTV, and so I had to have Time Warner, and then I had to get like this Roku where I could download the NFL package. And so, yeah, I've been through the rigmarole of having to switch cable companies for sports.
And that's frustrating, I think, to a lot of fans out there. You're a huge NFL fan. The NFL Sunday ticket's only available on DirecTV. What do you do on Sundays now? When you wake up in L.A., how do you watch games? And this is, by the way, a big thing that I think L.A. sports fans have just started to recognize is when I was out in L.A. early, when I started to do Fox Sports, before there were the Rams and the Chargers there, L.A. sports fans got spoiled because they got all the best games, right? And then when you get your own team locally – then you start getting your local games, and a lot of people are like, wait, I wanted to watch the Raiders, or I wanted to watch the Patriots, or whoever it is that's actually more popular in that market for big games. What do you do now, like on a Sunday when you wake up and you want to watch NFL football all day?
Well, I have the Sunday ticket, but it's like an app that
okay.
I watch through Roku, so I stream it online through with Roku. I have Time Warner Cable. But I have this, you know, through with this Roku, whatever. And look, man, I'm so old. I had to have a kid that I work with come over and hook it up
Install.
And show me how to do it.
Yeah.
But so I still have the Sunday ticket. I just don't have DirecTV.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there who are baffled by the technology because it's getting more and more complicated every year and the costs keep going up and then you're not going to necessarily be able to get your game. A lot of people out in L.A. can't watch the Dodgers. Anyway, I think that whole story is utterly fascinating because it calls into question some of the reasons why conference expansion happened, everything else. So we've been having a big discussion about that. And I want to start this question off with you. Jerry Jones bought the Dallas Cowboys for $68 million. They are now worth, according to the most recent Forbes estimate, over $4 billion. Now, back in the day, in the early days of the NFL, which wasn't even that long ago, 35, 40 years ago almost, some guys in the NFL still had multiple jobs, right? Like the reason why training camp existed, which is starting across the whole country today, is because guys had to get in shape because they might have been selling insurance the whole offseason or they might have been working on a car lot. Now guys are making millions of dollars a year to play football by and large, and you've got owners like Jerry Jones that have gone from, you know, $68 million, a lot of money. It ain't nowhere near $4 billion, which is the amount of money that he's increased the value for the Dallas Cowboys. So, big question for you. Can football continue to grow, or are we near peak football?
Oh, I think football can continue to grow financially. You know, I'm not sure if the ratings can continue to increase and expand at the pace they were. But I'm not sure they have to because, again, live sports is the only thing that's pretty much DVR-proof. And so live sports just keep escalating in value as it's hard for anything else on television to be attractive to advertisers because people fast-forward through the commercials. I think the NFL and these other sports leagues can continue to grow economically. And, you know, I think they will as long as they avoid major calamities like dirtying up their brand by presenting themselves as being an unpatriotic league and a bunch of guys that don't want to stand for the national anthem.
We're talking to Jason Whitlock at Whitlock Jason. You had a robust and uninhibited debate about the anthem on your show. It was really good. Speak for yourself with a variety of different perspectives. I think James Harrison was on with you, among other people. I watched it. I thought it was really good. Your perspective is, if I'm an owner, I'm not negotiating with the players. Everybody has to stand for the national anthem. Why?
Because since the 1960s, Pete Rozelle, when he was commissioner, came up with a strategy on how they were going to surpass Major League Baseball as America's national pastime. And a big part of that strategy was building a brand around patriotism, make fans feel like, you know, other than going to church and joining the military, the most patriotic thing you can do is watch football on Sundays. And that's why they went through NFL Films and Ed Sable, they started presenting football in these highlight packages like it was a military event and like it's the most manly, masculine thing in the history of America playing football. It was all a strategy, and patriotism was a part of that strategy, and that's why they surpassed baseball and became this behemoth that, you know, is the most popular pop culture force that we've ever seen. It's the number one show on five different television networks. And so the players don't understand this, one, because we fail the players. They don't get to get educated on their sport. You know, literally, I think they should be taught this in college. Like any music major, anybody else that's in a serious field that earns a lot of money, you can actually study it. Many of the players don't understand how they got there, how they went from guys just 30 years ago that needed another job during the off season to guys now that can make generational wealth playing the game. If they understood how they got there, they would then understand why, okay, this is why what we're doing doesn't make sense to ownership, and it doesn't make sense for us. Because when you play a game that dangerous and that violent, you're only let's make as much money as I can in shorter time as possible, and let me get out of here with my health, and then I can take that money. There's no owner that's saying, hey, guy, that doesn't say you have a right to support the cause that you say you're supporting. Just during the national anthem, before kickoff, that's not the time. And you should actually take the money you're earning and support these causes. We're not against your cause. We're just telling you this isn't the proper time and place, because we're here to conduct businesses in football, make as much money as we possibly can, acquire this generational wealth, use your wealth to support the things you believe in. Don't dirty up this league at this time because there's idiots on Twitter that think this is great.
Talking to Jason Whitlock at Whitlock Jason on Twitter, and I've been on this for a little bit. When I see players come out and say, hey, if you don't like it, fans, don't come to the game, I wonder, like, at its most basic level, if this is a failing of Roger Goodell and the owners to understand and explain where money comes from, right? Because I try to teach this to my kids. Like, they're like, Dad, I want to get this toy. And I'm like, okay, like, let's go look on it. And they know that you can find any toy on Amazon. And, you know, I'll be like, do you know where Dad's money comes from? And they're like, well, you talk, and people just give you money to talk. And I'm like, well, okay, you know, but like there is a work ethic involved in where Dad's money comes from, which allows me to buy you toys. And I feel like there are a lot of people out there that never take the next step of understanding where their paycheck comes from, right? And this is why a big thing I do on this show is talk about think about life as an employee versus an owner. If you're thinking about life from an owner perspective, you are probably going to advance in the world because you're thinking about the larger picture than just if you're going to get a paycheck every 2 weeks. If you're thinking about it from the employee perspective, you are always going to be slave to whether or not that paycheck shows up in 2 weeks because you're not thinking about where that money comes from. How many pro athletes and just employees in general in the world do you think really break down where their money comes from? Because to me, this is a big disconnect. And when I see a player say, hey, if you don't like it, don't come to the game, I'm like, that's literally the dumbest thing you could say.
You blame Roger Goodell and NFL ownership. I blame colleges and universities and a system that doesn't allow these kids to get taught about their profession while they're in school. Once you hand a young person, 22, 23 years old, $1 million salary or even a $500,000 salary of a $5, $6, $10 million signing bonus, it's very hard to teach that person once they have that amount of money when they're that young. And then the other group that I would blame is like, if I'm running the union, DeMaurice Smith, it's his job to look out for the best interest of the players. And so I blame the union. That's who, after the school and educational system, the union is doing these guys a disservice by not explaining to them this business. And again, I look at a guy like DeMaurice Smith, and I wonder if he even knows. And I say that in all seriousness. He's not a football person. He's some mercenary who had no background in professional sports that they've brought over to run this thing. And Gene Upshaw was just absolutely destroyed by the media when he ran the Players Union. And the guy actually did a great job, far better than DeMaurice Smith is doing. But the media will never talk about that because it's so rigged. DeMaurice Smith appears to be woke, and so everybody loves him. But Gene Upshaw was a football person who figured out, like, man, the amount of money we can make now, this isn't the old NFL Players Union when he played and we were making $25,000, $40,000 a year. We're now making millions. We're more in partnership with these guys, and let's figure out how we can all get richer together. I just don't see that mentality from the Players Union right now, and it's a disservice to the players.
I agree with you. We're talking to Jason Whitlock at Whitlock. Jason, all right, we haven't talked a lot about this story, but you guys did a good job discussing it on Speak for Yourself, and it got a lot of attention. Around the All-Star game, Josh Hader, who is a Major League Baseball pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers, during the All-Star game, somebody went back and found out that he had sent a lot of insensitive tweets 7 or 8 years ago when he was a 17 or 18-year-old kid. He comes out of the All-Star break to go take the mound to pitch in Milwaukee, and he gets, for many people, a standing ovation. Your reaction to that story, which was covered to a certain extent by people saying, oh, this is the Milwaukee Brewers fans being racist and supporting what this kid had tweeted back when he was 17 or 18. How did you take it?
I took it as Brewers fans were supporting a guy who they felt was being mistreated unfairly by the American media and by social media. That the guy's 24 years old now. He was 17 at the time, and people have dug up these old tweets and now are coming down on him like he's Adolf Hitler. And it's just not the case. I don't know what people were like when they were in high school, but I'm 51 years old, and I remember my high school days pretty vividly, and I remember what kids did when I was in high school. They'd listen to music, get pissy drunk, and thank God we didn't have cell phones and we didn't have the access of social media where we could tweet out our dumb thoughts. Maybe this didn't happen when the kid was drinking, but I'll just say this. When we were in high school, we thought, said, did really insensitive, stupid things that I certainly wouldn't want to be judged on as an adult. And so I think getting booby trapped from things you did 17 years ago is going to cause a reaction from normal people to be like, hey, man, this is unfair. And then when you look at the way the black players on the Milwaukee Brewers team rallied around him at his press conference, stood behind him. And so I'm looking at the people, the black players on the Brewers that are dealing with this kid every day and how they feel about him. They clearly feel like the stuff that he tweeted out 7 years ago doesn't explain who Josh Hader is. And so I saw the standing ovation more as a F you to the media and some, hey, we feel a little sympathy for Josh Hader and we want to show you some support, I don't see it as some big flaming sign of racism or bigotry. I just don't think that's what it's about. And then me, again, just going back to my high school days and some of the things that I did as a kid that I'm absolutely ashamed of. And they were much worse than putting out some few idiotic tweets like he did. I don't want to be judged on that. And so I saw a lot of people, the black teammates and the fans, saying, hey, man, let's don't judge somebody off of what they did at 17 years old. And so that's how I saw it.
One of the things I think is also interesting is the degree to which local fan bases will support guys.
Anything.
Even if they've done bad things. For instance, it's not gotten a lot of discussion, but people have forgotten that when Ray Rice, before the video came out of Ray Rice punching his fiance, he was suspended for 2 games and he showed up for training camp at Ravens practice and he got a standing ovation from Ravens fans.
I thought it was at a preseason game, Clay.
I can't remember exactly.
I think it was at a preseason game. We did the research, and it was before the video, but everybody knew he had been involved in domestic violence, and Ravens fans gave him a standing ovation.
Yeah, and obviously this is less significant in terms of violence, but Barry Bonds in San Francisco got standing ovations, the only place he got standing ovations, even when people knew that he had been part of the steroids
era. Let me give you a better one.
Yeah.
At any point, did Los Angeles Lakers fans turn their back on Kobe Bryant? At any point?
Not even during
the Colorado
incident? Yes.
At no point.
No, they never did.
They worshiped Kobe Bryant. When Kobe Bryant got busted using a homophobic slur and, you know, he got fined by David Stern, at no point did Los Angeles Lakers fans turn their back on him. They worship Kobe Bryant. And so, again, we have to have more nuanced, more intelligent, mature conversations than this gotcha game we keep playing in the media. It's just silly and stupid. Fans are fanatical, and what they tend to do with their own players is show support. I'm a Kansas City Chiefs fan. Tyreek Hill is one of the most exciting players to ever be added to the Kansas City Chiefs. Involved in some really abhorrent domestic violence before he was a member of the Chiefs. Chiefs fans love this guy. Love him. And so it's this whole woke thing. I'm just going to keep it all the way. It irritated me this week. I read Jemele Hill's column over at ESPN. And she kept writing or saying, what about the people Josh Hader's words hurt? And I just kept going, can we name them? Because when he was 17, I would imagine he had 30 to 100 Twitter followers. This was a tree falling in the woods 7 years ago that no one heard. And so no one, who were these people that were offended and hurt by them? It wasn't until 7 years later that someone, hey, look what he said. You should be offended and hurt by this. It's just there were no victims to Josh Hader's crime. And so it's all a media stunt. It's all people using Josh Hader to virtue signal and say, I'm a great person and I'm patrolling white people and their whole past, and I'm monitoring it and policing it, and we're trying to destroy them by pretending that what Josh Hader said to his 30 to 100 Twitter followers 7 years ago caused great damage in America. It just didn't happen.
Outstanding stuff, as always, from Jason Whitlock. Go follow him at Whitlock Jason on Twitter. Watch his show. Speak for yourself on FS1.